KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Six.
From KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Hot, really, really hot. How does the heat impact things that grow? Our gardening panel will join us later this hour. In Egypt, political tempers have been hot. Opponents of President Mohamed Morsi have been in the streets demanding his resignation. Those protests turned violent over the weekend. Yesterday, the Egyptian military stepped in. Joining us with more on the latest events is Boris Udaragahi. He's Middle East correspondent for the Financial Times based in Cairo. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Can you walk us back to what happened this weekend?
Oh, I mean, basically, you've had this grassroots campaign organized by activists, some of the same activists who participated in the 2011 uprising against Hosni Mubarak, organized by activists, political parties, the signature campaign calling for Mr. Morsi to step down from office because of his alleged incompetence and his attempts to Islamicize the society and the government. Well, people didn't think this would go anywhere, but in fact, this signature campaign caught fire. They claim they have 22 million signatures demanding that Morsi step down and that new elections be called. And this culminated, the signature campaign, in an amazingly massive protest on Sunday, unprecedented, really, according to most witnesses, throughout Egypt, as millions of people came demanding that Morsi step down from office. There was some violence, but given the history of the region and the recent history here, actually, surprisingly, not that much violence, given what has happened here in the last 2.5 years. The day after the protest, the military came in with this statement basically saying that Mr. Morsi and the opposition had better sort of formulate some kind of roadmap to get the country out of its current political crisis, or the military would impose its own roadmap. And that's where we stand today when the Brotherhood and its allies essentially came out defiantly saying that they would not step down, the president would not resign, the elections that brought him to power were legitimate and internationally recognized, and so they have also now called on their supporters to head into the streets in vast numbers.
Now, let me ask you about the roadmap. I read the general's release, and our own roadmap is not a specific thing. What are people thinking that means?
I think people have different definitions for what that means. According to the Tamarod, or rebellion movement, that has organized the signature campaign and Sunday's march, they want President Morsi to step down. They want the Constitution to be scrapped. They want Parliament that was elected scrapped. And they want a sort of new transitional process. They want to do a do-over, basically, from the 2011 revolution, whereby the head of the Constitutional Court would take over as honorary president, and a government of technocrats would manage the country until a new constitution is drawn up and elections are held. This is, you know, completely, it's like basically they're asking for 5 elections that have been held in this country to be negated and to go back to square one.
Is that what the military wants as well?
No one's quite sure what the military wants. Military will announce tomorrow if, in fact, the various parties don't come to some kind of agreement. Military will announce its plan, its proposed roadmap tomorrow. There have been some leaks, but I'm not going to honor them at this point because nothing official has been stated.
Now, Boris Udaragahi, in the meantime, we've been hearing reports that more than a half dozen officials in the Morsi government have resigned.
Yeah, in fact, people are resigning, especially those who are not affiliated with Islamist movements and the Muslim Brotherhood. Those people are bailing ship in sort of expressing solidarity with the protest.
Whoops, I think we just lost his phone line. That was Borzu Dargahi, who's Middle East correspondent for the Financial Times based in Cairo. Joining us with more on Egypt's political turmoil from this side of the ocean is Ellis Goldberg. He's a professor of political science at the University of Washington. Hi. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, you heard Borzu Dargahi in Cairo just as we, as he got disconnected, talking about the fact that some of the leaders in the Morsi government have stepped down. I want to go back, though, to this idea of the elections. Morsi calls himself Egypt's first democratically elected president. Can you call Egypt at this point a true democracy?
Well, I'm not sure you can call very many places true democracies. There was certainly a presidential election. Morsi did win a runoff, and by many accounts, it was a relatively fair election. The problem with the elections is that Morsi himself is a member of a party that has very high levels of discipline, and as president, was never able to separate himself from the needs of his own party to make really independent decisions as president of an entire country, and also to create a situation in which parliament could move forward to solving problems of the Egyptian economy and Egyptian society.
Well, let's talk about the Muslim Brotherhood. Who are they exactly?
Well, there are really two different aspects to the Muslim Brotherhood. It's a group that's been around for a fairly long time. Obviously, it was founded in 1928. But basically, it's a fairly large and somewhat heterogeneous group at the base, whose members do, however, accept that they will act in accord with decisions made by the leadership. Essentially, over the last 6 or 7 years, that leadership has become more and more concentrated in a small group of people who are usually characterized as hardliners. And in fact, most of the people within the top leadership of the Muslim Brothers, who in 2007, 2008, 2009 evoked a sense among American students of the area that the Muslim Brothers were changing or becoming more moderate, almost all of those people have been forced out of the organization over the last 4 or 5 years.
Well, it's interesting because this morning in the New York Times, there was a report that very conservative Islamic non-Brotherhood members, I guess, were in the streets as well, calling on Morsi to step down. So I guess I'm confused about the connection between various religious factions in Egypt at this point.
Well, I find that the New York Times and often many American commentators themselves seem to be somewhat confused. There's no doubt that within the ranks of the Muslim Brotherhood itself, there are people who don't necessarily agree with the current line of the top leadership. There are also other religious groups in Egypt. So, for example, just to take two things at random, the so-called Salafi Nur Party has itself actually come out against Morsi, although they were a political ally of the Muslim Brothers for the last year, off and on. They've basically said the threat of civil war is too dangerous. We have to move forward, and we simply cannot oppose, as an Islamist party, the will of the majority of the Egyptian people. By the same token, the leaders of the Azhar have really been very, very critical of the Muslim Brothers. So the claim by the Muslim Brothers that they somehow represent Islam or an Islamic response to the problems of modernity was always not a very plausible kind of claim, and I have no idea why so many people in the U.S. really accepted it.
Well, thank you for helping clear that up. So specifically, I guess let's talk about what Mohamed Morsi has achieved in the year since he took office. It has only been 12 months.
He hasn't achieved a whole lot. Now, his claim would be that there's not much that he could have achieved, that 12 months isn't long enough. What he has achieved was being the first democratically elected president of Egypt, which is more an achievement of the Egyptian people. Mm. And he also achieved making a deal with the army to get it to remove itself from politics. What he obviously did not achieve was actual civilian control over the army, and his plaintive cries over the last several days that he somehow does control the army is testimony to that. In terms of the economy and in terms of a variety of other areas that are of importance to the Egyptian people, Morsi has made very little progress. He dallied with the idea of doing one of the most important things that Egypt needs to do, which is to cut subsidies on energy, which really benefit a skewed section of the population, especially within the upper classes, and then withdrew from that precisely because his party and he were afraid they wouldn't win an election if they actually went forward with that. So I would say his accomplishments are not terrifically great.
Is it specifically the economy that has ignited the protests?
Well, I think there are several things. His attacks, or the attacks at least of his party on the judges, his attempt to implement his own constitutional declaration before the adoption of the new constitution, when he attempted to shield his own actions by fiat from court review, his appointment of a new prosecutor, which was deemed by the courts to be illegal, and the degree to which members of his party have really engaged in sectarian conflict. And Morsi has been extremely lukewarm in his condemnation of things, for example, like the lynching of four Shiites in Giza, just on the edge of Cairo last week. And so I think people have a very sharp fear that Morsi and his party are saying one thing and doing something else. Now, that may be quite unfair to Mr. Morsi, and it may be that what Mr. Morsi needed was a lot more time, but it's also pretty clear that given the critical situation in the economy and in the polity, Egyptian people in large numbers felt that there was no way to allow him to do that. The one other thing that's worth noting is that in what you might think of as, I don't know if it's a democracy, but an ordinary constitutional regime, the response to all of this would have been for the president to dismiss the parliament, to dismiss the prime minister, and choose a new one. And for a variety of reasons, President Morsi neither wanted to nor was able to accomplish this.
We're talking with University of Washington Professor Ellis Goldberg about the situation in Egypt. So what does it mean, then, if President Morsi either couldn't or wouldn't dismiss the prime minister? What does it mean that many other top officials are fleeing his government?
Well, they're resigning.
Yes.
But I'm saying in terms of the responsibility of a top leader, he's the one at whose desk the buck stops, as a U.S. president used to say.
Uh-huh.
So there's a difference between members of the administration, most of whom are not technically members of the Muslim Brothers, deciding that they've had enough and resigning, and Morsi taking responsibility for what's going on and making some decisions. It's a little bit like when President Obama actually has to fire an official. We realize that presidents don't like to fire their officials. We realize that administrators from, frankly, the University of Washington all the way up to the President of the United States like to protect their subordinates, but ultimately there are times when they can't. This is one of those times. But Morsi was incapable of recognizing, it seems, that things had come to an end. And the constitution that had been drafted and put into place in large measure by the Muslim Brothers made it almost impossible for a president either to get rid of a prime minister or to dissolve the House and call for new elections.
Well, we just heard Financial Times correspondent Borzu Dargahi saying that he felt that sort of the core group that is leading this rebellion would like a do-over of elections. Is that even a possibility at this point?
Well, of course, I mean, I'm not sure what you're asking. Of course, I would guess, of course, it's a possibility. You can have another set of elections. Whether or not how different they're going to be and whether they will create stable governing institutions is a very different question than whether or not the Muslim Brothers were capable of accomplishing the historic task that was placed upon them.
What will happen if Mohamed Morsi does not step down?
Well, there are several possibilities, I suppose. Some people have said that if he doesn't step down, the army will have to take over the presidential palace by force. I think given what we've seen, it's equally plausible that the army will simply decide to ignore President Morsi. It's quite possible to cut off. He's actually basically under army custody in the Quba Palace, not very far from the presidential palace. It would be quite possible to leave him where he is, cut off his phones, have new elections, and let everything go forward while President Morsi and his supporters indulge in the fantasy that they actually continue to govern Egypt.
I know that President Obama made a phone call to Morsi and is calling for calm and patience. Does, at this point, an American president's, if not alliance, but seeming reaching out to his Egyptian counterpart, carry any weight?
As far as I can tell, with many Egyptians, it carries negative weight.
Negative weight.
Yeah, I think there's a tendency at this point, certainly among the millions of Egyptians who showed up in the streets, to wonder exactly why it is that whenever they find a president unacceptable, the U.S. finds it extremely difficult to imagine the possibility of change. Now, it might be that President Obama's judgment about where Egypt should go and what Egyptians should do is a valid one. There are certainly Egyptians who would agree with him. But in fact, large numbers of Egyptians find it very peculiar that the president seems incapable of recognizing exactly what their demands are.
And just a last area of conversation has to do with the role of the military. You mentioned earlier in our conversation that one thing Mohamed Morsi had achieved was to get the military to sort of step aside and make way for a constitution. So what does it mean that the military has inserted itself back into this leadership crisis?
Well, I would say it means that President Morsi misunderstood what had happened. I guess if you want to use the analogy of a chess game, if you're playing with a stronger player and they offer you the queen as a sacrifice, you might want to be a lot very, very thoughtful about whether you should take it. So when Morsi believed that he had made a deal with the army to get them out, while at the same time allowing them constitutionally to retain many of their privileges and much of their authority. And then when he decided not to focus very much on what they were doing, but on a variety of other issues that seemed to him more pressing, including his conflict with other political forces, maybe that wasn't the wisest political move he could have made.
Many of the protesters, I've seen photos of them via Twitter, welcomed the military's announcement yesterday that it was going to come up with its own roadmap if Morsi did not follow the will of the people within 48 hours. Do you feel confident that the military would pave the way for elections?
I don't feel very confident about anything. but what I think is clearly many people, Egyptian political analysts, activists, are quite skeptical of the army. But, you know, it's a little bit like the United States. I realize that lots of my friends in politics in the United States are very skeptical of the army. But when you get right down to it, most Americans probably still have a fairly high regard for the army as an institution, even if they don't like the policies that it has often been engaged in following around the world. So the reality is that most of the people you're seeing on the streets in Egypt still rather strongly support the army, despite all of the problems that it caused and despite the fact that armies are not generally themselves democratic institutions.
Do you imagine that Mohamed Morsi will step down tomorrow at the end of 48 hours?
I actually would have to say that I have no idea. What he and his supporters have indicated is that they do not intend to step down. It's very difficult to know if he's playing a game or living in a delusive world.
Ellis Goldberg is a professor of political science at the University of Washington. Thank you very much for joining us, and we'll all be watching to see what happens in Egypt over the next 24 hours.
Thank you very much for having me.
This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman.
Why are we Americans so interested in the British royals? Some thoughts on that in a moment. ...71 degrees in Seattle, and we're expecting lots of sun for the next few days, with temperatures gradually cooling. Today's predicted high is 82. Tomorrow, it's 80. And Thursday, we're expecting a high of 76. It's getting harder to find affordable apartments in Seattle, despite the apartment building boom. We're going to get some tips on how to find affordable rentals in Seattle today during the noon hour on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. 1026, I'm Bernard Ouellette. Some tips for summertime gardening in 10 minutes.
This is Weekday. I'm Katie Sewell. The magazines in the grocery store aisle are fully anticipating the birth of Prince William and Kate Middleton's child. Their first baby is expected in mid-July. 24 million people tuned in to watch their nuptials 2 years ago. And if you think that's a lot, 750 million people worldwide watched Charles and Diana get married. Many Americans can actually remember precisely where they were when they heard that Princess Diana had died. So the real question is, why do Americans care so much about English royalty? And here to help me answer that question is Jenny Spohr. She's the author of the book Heirs and Spares, a historical novel set in 1569 while Elizabeth I is on the English throne. She's been studying the trials and tribulations of the royals since she watched Princess Diana take that long walk down the aisle. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Katie.
So can you answer that question? Why do Americans care so much about English royalty?
Well, there's so many, you know, different answers you can give. You can give the socioeconomic answers and all those, you know, cultural things. We're connected to them. We're sort of, America is sort of the runaway black sheep teenager of England, you know, that's longing for mom and dad, and we keep looking back. But, you know, I think really what draws us in is that it is a fairy tale made real. We all have this instinctual drive to love a fairy tale and to see that happen, much like Joseph Campbell describes in The Hero's Journey about how this, it's this meta narrative that as humans we're drawn to. And I think we're drawn to the fairy tale and we're seeing it happen all over our televisions. You mentioned Charles and Diana, and I watched them get married at a very impressionable age and was too naive to realize that there were bad things going on in the background and that didn't end very happily. But you're seeing this Cinderella story, this King Arthur and his knights happening in real life, and you can't help but be pulled into that.
It makes sense that when you're a much younger person in your childhood, yes, watching Princess Diana get married, that she would seem like some sort of fairy princess, like perhaps you were aspiring to be at that point.
Oh, yeah, I wanted the puff sleeves for sure.
Yeah. So, but then why as adults, when we know that there's more to it, we know that there's stuff going on behind the scenes and there's negotiations going on, why still are we writing about everything that Kate Middleton wears and critiquing the ceremony?
Exactly. You know, that is interesting that as, you know, adults, many Americans stayed up till 3 a.m, you know, to watch it live, watch it happen live, the wedding. And I think it still is that little bit of childhood hope and that little bit of magic that we wish we could still believe in is still inside us, because we have plenty of, you know, American royalty, I'd say in air quotes. You know, you've got your Kardashians and your Hiltons, and but they're just really rich people, right? And when you peel back the surface, it's sort of tawdry. But the British royals have this 1,000-year history, and they have actual castles and actual, you know, horse-drawn carriages that it just comes to life. And I think it's fun for people. It's fun to be able to get back to those times when everything was, you know, princesses and knights and dragons and things.
Well, you've thought a great deal about this, having written your own historical novel about it, Heirs and Spares. What would you think it's like to be Kate Middleton now? Have you imagined being in her place with all this history behind you?
Yes. Well, I have, specifically her being pregnant. She and I shared the same morning sickness syndrome. So I felt deeply for her when she had that. And certainly being a princess does not negate real life hitting you. But I am sure that she is, especially looking at recent history and looking at Diana and how things went with her and how she was estranged from the royal family throughout her marriage as well as in the divorce. And Kate Middleton is trying to play things pretty close to the vest. I mean, she really is, for the most part, in public, fairly perfect, dressed very well. But I think she also really cares for William. And I think William cares for her, which is different than certainly Charles and Diana and some of the other royal marriages. In fact, most royal marriages throughout history were made for convenience or political expediency and not for love. And so I think it's recharging sort of this royal watching and this fairy tale-ness again, because it truly is Cinderella, right? She's a commoner. She's fell in love with her prince and he with her is carrying her off to her castle. And so I think she's probably trying to play into that a bit, but also, I mean, she's 9 months pregnant. She is sitting in front of a fan, eating as much as she wants, just waiting for this baby to come.
Well, maybe in that way, it's watching them is like what happened after, you know, happily ever after.
Exactly. Yeah. It's the backstory, or it's the future of the after, the happily ever after is what we hope for. And that's what was so tragic with Charles and Diana, right?
Well, you mentioned that Kate Middleton keeps things very close to the vest.
Mm-hmm.
Diana lived a lot of her life out in the public, but she also kept a lot of things personal.
Yes.
Is that the difference between, I mean, we are obsessed with our people like the Paris Hiltons, and that we see that in the checkout stands as well.
Yeah.
But is that part of the mystique of why they're different? They're set aside from our rich people.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they're set aside again for this 1,000 years of history that they were born into this. It used to be the divine right of kings that literally God literally chose these people to reign over. And there's a little bit of that cloaking of mystical, spiritual essence that surrounds them, that just doesn't surround politically powerful people here like the Kennedys or say rich people that we see in the checkout stands as well.
I'm speaking with Jenny Spohr. She's the author of the new book, Heirs and Spares, a historical novel that's set in 1569. That's when Elizabeth I was on the English throne. Why did you decide to set the book at that period of time?
Well, the Tudor era is one that has fascinated everybody. You don't have to be a royal watcher to like the Tudor era. And the Tudor era, of course, started with Henry Tudor, Henry VIII, and Henry and his six wives. And he, in fact, my female protagonist in the book, her name's Annalore, she is an amalgamation of all of his wives. So her character is sort of this combination of Henry's six wives. And he's perfect fodder for fiction and for writing. I mean, he's beheading people, he's having affairs, he's splitting from Rome. But what's interesting about him and subsequently his daughter Elizabeth, who's one of the most successful rulers that ever was, that is that he also changed the course of our history. So as Americans, we would be perhaps a Spanish colony rather than an English one. If Henry had not split from Rome, we might be, you know, speaking Spanish and Catholic. And so as much as we sort of laugh at the royal watching now, even in recent history, with the abdication in the 40s in World War II, if England had stopped being our ally, they were one of the superpowers. I mean, Britain was a superpower not so long ago. And so the course of their history actually does affect ours. And I think there's a draw there for us too.
And so when you look at the history of America becoming its own, do you find that this historical fascination with the British royalty is throughout our entire history?
Completely. In fact, in 1783, so right after we've finally broken from England and the monarchy, there are periodicals. So, you know, your People magazine's predecessors back then were just selling out anytime there was anything about the royals, and it was something as little as what they had to eat at some fancy party. I mean, it was that same fascination of the fashion and what they're doing and not necessarily the political motivation. So way back then, they've been popular.
And for you personally, what's your fascination?
Well, I am actually in line for the British throne, Katie.
Oh,
so
are you?
You may kiss my ring right now. Yes. like 10,000 people need to die simultaneously for me too, including my older brother. I'm sorry, Justin, if you're listening. But so that's part of it. Family lore. I'm also of English descent. I'm English and Scottish. So I've always sort of looked into that. And again, I saw Diana get married at a very impressionable age. I was really young, and I was fascinated by her. And so, yeah, every time she was on People magazine, I bought it and watched her. And I think that drew me in. And, I was always doing make-believe with fairy princesses and things as well. So,
well, there's been speculation that going forward, what will happen to the royals? Maybe we don't need the royals anymore. You often hear people ask that question. They're not even running the political government really anymore. What do we need them for?
Yeah, they really don't. They don't.
What do we need them for?
There are much more figureheads now, although things could change in the future potentially. I think that they are needed, especially for people. And I speak as an American here, but I think they are needed as a figurehead that unifies their country, that is above the political fray. You know, they're not supposed to be involved in these political discussions. And so it's this person that's above, you know, their country that everyone can kind of rally behind and say, we're your subjects. So there's this sort of mystical bond between, you know, subjects and their monarch that we don't necessarily get here, especially in this generation in America. But that's there. And I just don't think the royalty is going to go anywhere soon because there's that bond. And because, again, they're living out that sort of wish fulfillment that we have of living out that fairy tale for us.
And sometime in the next few weeks, thousands of people will be gathering to see what name is written on the sign outside the castle.
That's so right.
We'll have to wait and see what happens. Yeah. Jenny Spohr is the author of Heirs and Spares. It's a historical novel that's set in 1569. If you want to get a copy, you can find it at Amazon.com. She's also the producer and host of the Kinling's Muse podcast. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me, Katie. It was a pleasure.
This is Weekday.
Jenny Spohr was talking with KUOW's Katie Sewell. It's 10:37. We're going to get some summertime gardening advice in a minute. 72 degrees in Seattle. It's mostly sunny. It's going to be sunny all day with an afternoon high of 82. Then we're expecting a clear sky overnight, dropping to 61, and tomorrow, Wednesday, some clouds in the morning, then mostly sunny again by afternoon with a high of 80. This past year, the iconic record store Easy Street Records in the Queen Anne neighborhood closed and was replaced by a bank. And now the Egyptian, an independent movie theater on Capitol Hill, and Bauhaus, an independent coffee shop, are closing. Is Seattle losing its character? We're going to take that up today at noon.
It has been hot, hotter, hottest. What does that do to our temperate-loving west side of the mountain gardens? Our Green Days gardening panel is here once again to try to answer this and other questions. In the studio with me, Greg Rayburn, the Vashon Basin steward, co-host of King County TV's Yard Talk, Marty Winget, who writes about garden and travel. Landscaping for Privacy is one of the books that she's written, among others, little small garden landscaping, things like that. You can find her at MartyWinget.com. And Laura Matter coordinates Seattle Tilth's Garden Hotline. She's a practicing horticulturalist. Nice to have you all in here. And our phone number is 206-543-5869, 1-800-289-5869. Well, it's been really hot. Is that going to hurt things? It goes from rainy and cool to like in a...
Well, my roses look fabulous.
They like this?
They do. They look great.
Oh, okay. So this is good for our gardens.
Well, for some plants.
I haven't seen anything suffering yet. I think if it was extensive, you might see a little bit more. And yeah, always jumping from that cool to hot is kind of hard. I think it's harder on us. Really, the key is keeping things hydrated.
And we did have quite a bit of rainfall leading up to
it.
We had
So
what things, what do you, like the roots were good because they had a lot of water down in there?
Exactly, which they can still tap into. I didn't notice all the weeds are sure going to seed pretty quick.
Yeah. Yes.
I noticed that my lettuce went from being edible to bolting within 3 days. So that was not happy. Maybe that's those cool crops.
It's about time for that to be happening anyway. It would have happened with whether it was 90 degrees or 70 degrees.
So. Okay, I'll feel a little bit better. our email address is weekday@kuow.org, and we have a picture that I'm going to have to turn my computer around so our panel can see it. This is from Christina in Kirkland. I've attached a photo of an unfortunate sunflower, my unfortunate sunflower. I wonder if someone could suggest what's wrong. It's the fourth one which has wilted and died. I had previously had zinnias in this bed. 2 years ago, they started wilting like this. I thought maybe the sunflowers will do better. I guess not. Is there something evil lurking in my soil? Marty has wheeled over to see these sad... The top of the sunflower has drooped over, and the leaves are just hanging there totally.
No, Laura, you can go take a look at it if you want. It really is drooping from, but it doesn't look like there's any injury on the stem.
It looks like it is
a nice arching droop.
And the other ones are not drooping, just the one?
Well, there's only one sunflower in the picture.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
The other things don't look like sunflowers. So there's things that look healthy down low, and then there's just this thing, and the leaves are all kind of limp.
I don't know what that would be. I mean, usually wilting like that is some kind of water related issue. if there was something in the soil, I would expect it to be affecting the other things. Some kind of disease issue, I don't think would be have that kind of look to it.
Should she take her soil somewhere to be tested?
Ooh.
That's hard to say.
I don't know. I would first investigate what diseases attack sunflowers.
Okay.
And zinnias, I guess. It does look like a water issue. You know, we think that sunflowers don't need water.
Oh,
but
they need a lot of water.
They do need water.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so maybe checking the moisture level in the soil. And zinnias, too. You know, all those heat-loving annuals that grow so well in the eastern half of the country grow well because they get a lot of water there. They get a lot of rain, and we don't.
Okay. So she should test down low. Maybe she's just giving it just a cursory water.
Dig her finger in and see what the soil's like.
Okay. Christina, dig your finger in and see what the soil's like. 543-5869 is our phone number, 1-800-289-5869. Bob is in Shoreline. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I have a problem with strawberries. I have them in containers. I have three containers. They're about 8 inches deep, and they don't produce any flowers or fruit, but they make endless shoots. Like they know, it's as though they know there's too many. They're crowded, and they want to go somewhere else.
Strawberries need a lot of sun. Are these guys getting plenty of sunshine?
Well, they get about a half a day maximum.
Oh, that may be part of what's going on there. The crowding issue, strawberries crowd themselves very easily, as you see. That doesn't usually stop them from flowering and producing. They may reduce, the amount of fruit they have. But, you know, typically you do want to thin them out from time to time and start over with newer plants. But I would imagine that getting them into a sunnier spot, if you have one in your yard, would be helpful for them.
Oh, I have an apartment, and you know.
What kind are these? The big strawberries?
Well, no, these are, I think, ever-bearing. I haven't bought any for years. These are all offspring of earlier. And that's another question: Are the young plants? Are younger plants more productive?
Yeah, they will be. You want to kind of change them out every few years, but right. You also might try the little alpine strawberries that seem to do a little bit better in shady conditions. Marcy's shaking her head because she personally has lots in her yard.
I do, and I was just thinking as you were talking, Laura, that they are in partial shade. I mean, they get not a lot of sun, and they have yielded lots of berries.
Yeah. They're not as big, but they're pretty tasty.
Yeah, they're, in fact, not as big as is an understatement.
Tiny. They're tiny.
They're tiny, but they're yummy, and it's sort of fun to go find them. They're like little jewels. Good luck with that, Bob. Maybe Bob should just start new with new plants.
Mm-hmm.
That's easiest. We have a lot of emails, not a lot of calls. So if you're near a phone, you can call 543-5869. Noel wants to know if it's possible to start honeysuckle from cuttings.
I would say that it probably is possible. And the place to look, I love this. 2 weeks in a row, I get to mention the Arboretum's booklet, Cuttings Through the Year, which you can buy from the gift shop at the Arboretum for, I think, $6.50. You can also get it online. So look at arboretumfoundation.org.
Are you working for them?
That. Mm-hmm. Paige Miller is going to love me mentioning the Arboretum 2 weeks in a row. Because that will tell you what time of year to take it, where to make the cutting. It's weird because some plants, you should make the cutting right under a pair of leaves or leaves on the stem, and others you make it right above. It's mm-hmm. tricky.
And then there's softwood cuttings, right, exactly. And hardwood cuttings.
And semi-softwood.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
The good news is that it's very rare that there's a perennial that or a woody vine or any of those that can't be propagated by cutting.
Okay, yeah. So get this Arboretum Foundation booklet and
Cuttings Through the Year.
Cuttings Through the Year. We're talking gardening as we do every Tuesday with Marty Wingate, Greg Rayburn, Laura Matter,
A lot of emailers, and you can call 543-5869. Barbara says, last week I asked about eliminating mountain beavers in our Kirkland Ravine. I spent the week harassing them. I think it worked. No more fresh holes, no squeaks, no movement. And she says, thanks. She sent us a video that you guys can look at after after the show. Thank you, though. Now we have a persistent bunny, cute but annoying. Are they as damaging as the mountain beaver?
Oh, they tend to operate in different ways.
They can be destructive. Yeah,
they love vegetable gardens.
Destructive? Okay.
Peter Rabbit.
Yes. Peter Rabbit. It's yes, no you joke. All remember.
Yeah. Broccoli and cabbage.
Farmer McGregor. Yes. Was that his name? Yes. Farmer McGregor. Paul and Madrona, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm wondering about these centipedes, or are they millipedes this year? There seems to be more than ever. And are they carnivores or herbivores? Do I squash them like a slug?
No, don't squash them.
Okay, yeah. Are they good for the garden?
They are, at the very least, neutral for the garden. But they're sort of, don't they eat decaying matter?
They do, and can be predators as well. So,
there you go. Yeah.
So you love these things. Is that what you're saying? He should embrace
his... Yeah, they're not going to hurt your plants. They're going to...
Going into my basement by the dozens, so I guess. I'll put them back out in the yard.
Yeah.
Oh, ew. How many do you have?
Oh, I've probably picked up 24 so far this year. More than most years.
What are you growing? I wonder what they like.
We just have a standard Seattle garden.
Huh. It's interesting.
Interesting.
No, you need to call a insect person.
All right. Well, thank you.
Thanks for that call. So you haven't heard about invasions of centipedes and millipedes,
no.
Just in Madrona, maybe.
But they are not bad.
Yeah. And anecdotally, it seems that the conditions have been really solid for bug populations this year. I've talked to several hikers that have said that they are really noticing a lot, it being a pretty buggy year.
Buggy year. I've noticed mosquitoes, so maybe that's true for millipedes or centipedes.
I noticed the summer spiders are ahead of the game.
Yes, they are.
Well, when you have some insects bound up, then the ones that eat those insects, they have big population boosts, so things tend to move in waves.
The waves of insects. Mike joins us now from Woodinville. Hello. Mike?
Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah.
My question is, I have about 600 to 700 foot of gravel driveway, and I have weeds coming through. There's probably about 4 or 5 inches of gravel, and there's weeds coming through, and I don't like to use poison. I don't want to get in groundwater. It's well systems out here. So I'm using a propane blowtorch and burning things out. I've gone through and done it once, and they pop back up. How many times would I have to do it before I actually killed the plant and he gets tired and says, I'm not going to do it anymore.
Well, what kind of weeds do you have?
Oh, you name it. I have grass. I have a variety. I mean, it's just even the ubiquitous buttercup comes up through the driveway. And, you know, I enjoy burning those guys out. it's everything. I can't go a particular genus or species or whatever. They're just green.
Yeah, well, in order to kill those perennials, the cooking the tops doesn't necessarily get them. So you have to toast the tops enough that they starve out the root, especially tap-rooted perennials with, like, dandelions and things like that. But if you're persistent, they will starve.
That's what I was – I mean, I quite frankly, I was disappointed. I burned the heck out of these, 15 gallons of propane and – 2 weeks later, they're back. It's green again. Not as much.
Well, that,
it's still green again. So I'm going through and doing it again right now. And I thought, well, how often will I, is this a, something I have to do multiple times every year? Or can I anticipate after, if I do one or two more cycles, it will eventually not bear fruit?
Yeah, you have to do it pretty routinely. And one of the things that'll help you, though, as far as the amount of propane, it's not quite as satisfying. I know it's much more fun to just hold that torch on there and just burn them. But really, you can just hit them and knock them back where you see the vegetation really wilt rather than char and blacken. And that is just as effective. So you really don't have to torch them for that long.
I know. It is probably fun, though.
It is. That thing sounds like a jet engine going off. It's so satisfying. Take that. Ah!
Okay, Mike, good luck with your weed patrol. That is, I know how much you loved the flame thrower.
It is fun. Yeah,
it is fun. Rico says he took 3 cuttings from his native orange honeysuckle a month ago, dipped the ends in Dip and Grow, stuck them in a small pot with soil under a plastic dome on my windowsill, all 3 rooted. I misted them with water every 2 to 3 days.
Excellent.
So I have Noel, who wanted to cut honeysuckle and make more. That's one way to do it. Anne in Redmond says, my lettuces are done. What can I plant in their place? Can I plant carrots? With 3 question marks. So that's an eager.
Yes.
Okay. Yes, Anne.
Carrots are great to plant through the month. They'll continue to grow and produce for you all season long. So those are one of the plants that you can actually start in April and just kind of do succession sowings for.
They don't.
Absolutely.
It's not about heat or cold or any of those things.
No. You know, once you get too far into the summer, it's not the weather that's the issue. It's the length of time to maturity.
Okay. We go now to Stephen, who's been holding for us in Issaquah. Hi.
Hi, everyone. Great show as always. I had a question about harvesting seeds and growing them at different elevations. My family frequently goes up to a pretty special and wonderful place with a lot of flower biodiversity up in eastern Washington called Bumping Lake. And I was curious if we harvested things like the lupin seeds and other wildflower seeds, if they might grow at lower elevations down in Issaquah.
It really depends on the species, but yes, many will grow fine down here in lower elevations. There are both perennial and annual lupins, but other species that, yeah.
And are they often damp meadow plants, or are they dry?
They can be either.
Okay, so it depends on the species. So
yeah, and that's,
you want to try to match the growing conditions, the soil and the water.
Yes, exactly. And sunlight is important. A plant that you might be more challenging is like the paintbrush or like the Indian paintbrushes.
Oh, yeah.
Those often have a relationship with like fescue grasses, and they share, you know, they're, I don't know if it's parasitic or symbiotic, but anyway, they work in conjunction with fescue. So if you have a particular plant that has those sorts of requirements, it's much more challenging to grow.
Got it. Well, I will give it a try. Thank you.
Thanks for your call. Michelle's in West Seattle. Hello.
Hi. We have a knotweed in our backyard that has been proliferating, and we want to get rid of it. And as we've been researching, it looks like it's something that we have to cut each stalk and then inject poison into. And this seems really prohibitive. It's really spread in our backyard. Is there a quicker way or lazier way to get rid of it?
No. No, sorry. It is one of the most challenging weeds out there, and it's incredibly damaging ecologically. So I'm happy to hear that you're interested in controlling it. And the sooner you get on it, the less work it'll be in the long run. But they tried many, many different ways over the years, and really that's probably the most effective and least environmentally damaging. There has been up in the Cedar River watershed, they've done some experiments covering areas with an impermeable membrane, like a tarp, but it allows water to come through but not light, and staking that down loosely so the stalks can kind of grow up, and then you trample it back down. But that's, you asked about time, and that's, you know, a 5-year process.
Wow.
Okay.
But even with using herbicides, you're also committing to a long process, because it's rare you get it all the first time.
Yeah.
If you go to, it sounds like you're already at kingcounty.gov/weeds. There's a lot of knotweed information there, and it is probably one of our toughest, especially from a restoration standpoint, because it can go in and just wipe out entire areas, and it wipes out the entire plant community.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, well, it's good to know I'm not alone.
No, you're not. No. Go fight the good fight, Michelle. Thanks for your call. We've got a few more minutes left. Doug's in Black Diamond. Hello.
I have a Spire apple tree, and it's 2 years now, and hasn't produced any blossoms or fruit. And I just wondering about the whole pruning regime for that. If I were to prune, to get bushy.
Okay, we're losing you on your cell phone. So, pruning apple trees to get them to bear fruit.
Well, an espalier tree is one that grows in two dimensions, kind of like a fence. And usually you buy, you don't have to, but you can buy them that way so that they're encouraging that kind of growth. And I would look at, you know, it's the second year. They should have bloomed this year, even though you're supposed to pick the blossoms off. Ooh, I hate that part. But I suppose you could wait another year if this is just the second year they haven't bloomed.
I definitely would. They need to develop the fruiting spurs and really get old enough to do something.
So. And I doubt if it needs much pruning, would you think?
It shouldn't. The pruning you do for it is to direct it sideways so that you're not letting it grow back out again. And
right, or straight up. Yeah, you don't want those straight up. Yeah, but you don't want to, certainly don't want to cut any of the spurs off.
No.
So you're advising patience.
Yeah.
Okay. Patience, Doug, in Black Diamond. And thanks for your call. And with that, a lot of folks have questions. We'll be back next week, and you can talk about them then, or call us, or email us, or go to the Green Days at Weekday at KOW. What is your official Facebook page name?
Green Days.
Just Green Days.
If you look for it that way.
You'll find it.
Not the band.
And these gardeners will answer questions there, too. Greg Rayburn, not weed specialist, is the Vashon Basin steward co-host of King County TV's Yard Talk. Laura Matter is a practicing horticulturalist and coordinator of Seattle Tilth's Garden Hotline. Marty Wingate writes about gardens and travel. You can find her online at martywingate.com. Thanks, all three of you, for coming in today.
Thanks.
Our show is produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amina Alsadi, Bernard Ouellette's our engineer. I'm Marcy Silman. Tomorrow, join us for a live performance from the duo Lamolo in our performance studio. That and news from Canada, some film comment, and a little bit of tech news with Todd Bishop coming up tomorrow on Weekday.
King County Executive Dow Constantine says bus service will be cut unless the county gets to ask for higher taxes. We'll have more on that in the news in a minute. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW-Tumwater, KQOW-Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
KUOW thanks the members of the Broadcasters Circle for their generosity and leadership support throughout the year. For more information on how you can become a Broadcasters Circle member, visit KUOW.org.
The birth of a child never goes quite the way you expect it to. But in 1780, the biggest challenge for a midwife wasn't simply delivering the baby.
The difficulty was going on a floating cake of ice across the river to get to a mother.
That's historian Laurel Ulrich, one of our guests this week on Backstory. Join us as we explore the history of what it has meant to be born in the USA.
That's Thursday, the 4th of July at noon on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Sodo Hydro, specializing in indoor and outdoor organic garden supplies and hydroponics, featuring grow lights, fresh brewed compost tea daily, and Baker Creek seeds, located south of the stadiums. Product information at sodohydro.com.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.